water falling. Peppers and chard germinated, lilies of the valley in full bloom, lilacs at peak. Swapped out storm windows for screens, finally. Work on the new O-deck continues and has become the sole topic of discourse in the house. Frank is just as obsessed as he was the first time. I read over my diary from back then and must remind myself that this time at least he is working with a willing and supportive cohort. Besides me, I mean. Jury's still out for me, re-Tristan. Prefer Melisande, but she's not in charge. Not clear if their relationship is personal or just professional. Not sure they're clear either. The schedule has been extended by 2 days to accommodate upgrades to the software and improvements to the building's electrical service. Whomever Tristan works for takes him seriously. Frank faced endless red tape whenever he requisitioned extension cords, for heaven's sake. 2 concerns regarding this project, besides the obvious reservations. First, Tristan insists on being inside the O-deck while it is in operation. He can't understand how that makes him the observed, not the observer. Uncle Victor's Labrador Retriever is in charge. Second, Frank, satisfied to be working on the physics, turns a blind eye to the supposed application. Magic. There are powers that be who take the magic premise seriously enough to buy Tristan a building and send him tanker trucks of liquid helium without any paperwork. Hard to reconcile this with common sense, Frank heedless. Also, Mel is concerned about a woman who contacted her claiming she can do magic. T and M's rendezvous with this woman has been delayed several times, and the woman is becoming verbally abusive. This does not stop them from intending to meet her, which will possibly happen tomorrow after the next O-deck go-round.
Diachronicle. Day 294. In which we become even more decoherent. 2 days later. When the liquid helium showed up in the unmarked stainless steel tanker truck, Tristan velcroed and zipped himself into a snowmobile suit, gave us the thumbs up, and stepped up into the O-deck, where, just for safety's sake, he pulled on an oxygen mask. Apparently, liquid helium was adept at finding and seeping through the tiniest leaks, so the cavity might fill up with helium and asphyxiate him before he knew it was happening. Once again, Oda walked around the building going through his checklist, and took his place before the console. By now, our expectancy was tempered by experience. Liquid helium, as I now knew, was 50 times as expensive as the liquid nitrogen we had been using, and a lot colder. Nitrogen became a liquid at 77 degrees above absolute zero, the point at which atoms would stop moving if such a state could be reached. But to do the same trick with helium, you had to chill it all the way down to a mere 4 degrees. By the standards of the normal human world, it was a distinction without a difference. Both were very, very cold. But to scientists like Oda, there was a world of difference between 4 degrees and 77. The liquid helium jacketing the O-deck would have radically different properties from LN2. Properties explainable in terms of Bose-Einstein statistics, an advanced concept in quantum mechanics that Tristan barely understood. And I couldn't make sense of it all. The gist of it seemed to be that the liquid helium would cloak the inner cavity of the O-deck inside a seamless jacket of matter, all of which was in the same quantum state. This was supposed to have some effect of isolating the cavity from the rest of the universe quantum mechanically, and greatly intensifying its effects. Cold as they were, the plumbing and the vessels were still boiling hot by liquid helium standards, and so after the LN2 had been pumped out, we had to go through another cycle of atmospheric exchange augmentation out the exterior vent ports before the system settled down. The digital thermometers began to read dramatically lower temperatures. Once the system had stabilized at 4 degrees above absolute zero, -269 degrees Celsius, Oda flipped the switch. This time, he let the system run for only 5 seconds before turning it back off. Tristan stumbled out of the O-deck, tugging convulsively at the oxygen mask. The balaclava came off with it. He was ashen-faced and looked as if he might be sick. He stumbled dizzily and then collapsed to his knees, barely beyond the threshold of the chamber. "Tristan!" I cried, as Oda knelt down to help him. But Tristan pushed him away and looked around at us all, dazed and yet wild-eyed.
"Where am I?"
he asked.
"Is this a dream? Or are we really here?"
"We're really here,"
said Oda gently.
"Are we in Boston?"
asked Tristan, and groaned.
"God, what a terrible headache. Where's Mom?"
I looked at Oda in alarm.
"Give him a moment,"
he said reassuringly. "What just happened to him?" I demanded, not reassured.
"I think he's just very disoriented."
"Isn't it 5 minutes ago?"
said Tristan.
"Don't I have to go into the O-deck before we can have this conversation?" "Somebody get him a glass of water,"
said Oda to the room in general. And then gently,
"Tristan, close your eyes for a few moments. You'll be fine."
Oda gestured me to step away, and I followed him, but my concern and attention remained on Tristan. He was now very still, glancing around at his surroundings with eyes only, as if trying to avoid vertigo. It seemed horribly wrong for Tristan Lyons to be so vulnerable.
"Is this what happened to the cat?"
I demanded of Oda.
"Well, you can't have a conversation with a cat. When I'd open the cavity, he would leap out in full Halloween mode. But I'd leave him, come back down an hour later, and he'd be fast asleep. When he woke up, you'd think nothing had happened. I repeated the experiment a few times, and the cat never seemed to remember what he was about to be subjected to. But then Rebecca saw, and made me stop."
Journal entry of Rebecca East Oda.
May 18th. Temperature about 64 degrees Fahrenheit, moist, no breeze. Barometer rising. Flowers and vegetables fending for themselves due to O-deck activity. To begin, this morning the new O-deck was successful, insofar as Tristan came out of it in the same state the cat once used to come out of the old O-deck. Melisande kept her head better than I did when I first saw the cat, but was clearly concerned. The following conversation, more or less. Frank, I predict Tristan will be fine shortly, but I don't think we should allow anyone to go into the O-deck until we have figured out how to protect them from that effect. Mel, what is the effect? Why is it happening? Frank, he is teetering on the edge of becoming non-local. Mel, non-what? Frank, his brain was suddenly not sure which precise reality it was operating in, and perhaps his body, too. So much to discover still. Nota bene. Sounding like an eager child. Sounding as if none of it happened 30 years ago. 5 minutes pass. Tristan, fully recovered. Why didn't you take notes of what I said when I first came out? Mel, trust me. You said absolutely nothing noteworthy. Tristan, that just sounds like your usual lip. I need cooperation. Frank, we were all here. She's right. Tristan, you do it, Stokes, so I can see what happens when you come out. Mel, I don't think so. Seriously, it was as if you'd gotten plastered at a frat party. Tristan, sounds like fun. Give it a go. Frank, I really don't think that you should push her, interrupted by Tristan. She could use a little loosening up. Come on, Stokes, it's a hazard of the job. Mel, I fail to see how becoming non-local falls within the parameters of my contractual obligations as a translator of dead languages. Tristan, it falls within the parameters of your wanting to know what it's like. Mel, apparently it's like being drunk. Been there, done that. Tristan, you know, you could be stuck in your tiny little office right now, grading papers about Aramaic declensions. Get your butt in there. Somebody get her a snowsuit with a balaclava and an oxygen mask. I wish that had been the end of the nonsense. It was barely the beginning.
Diachronicle. Day 294. Continued. 90 minutes later, despite my own best judgment, I was geared up and ready to begin the most ill-considered experiment of my life. To that point, I mean. Clearly, I have engaged in more boneheaded enterprises since then, else I would not currently be sitting here trying not to spill ink on my borrowed day dress. I hope it does not reflect badly on me to admit that I would have refused obstinately were I not so keen to please Tristan. A ridiculous impulse, given that he seemed to treat me as if I were his personal R2-D2, which was still preferable to Blevins's modus operandi. But there was something about his relentless focused clarity of purpose that made all things else fade in significance, including my own mental balance. I submit that I was not falling in love with him, but there was, inarguably, an intellectual seduction at work. He operated on my psyche the way a lively Mozart sonata might. And so, suited up to look like a cartoon character, I toddled into the Odek. It was frigid inside, and my breath came out in clouds until I put the oxygen mask on. The cavity had a cool clinical feel with all those LEDs staring at me. I felt as if I were on the set of a half-assed, low-budget sci-fi flick. All right, I said with a purposeful nod. And the door closed. I could feel my pulse at my temples, hear my breath amplified within the mask. It was frightening and exhilarating, and I had never felt so alive. Blevins could eat my shorts. I cannot describe what happened next, because I do not remember. Immediately, it seemed, I found myself in a very bland, undecorated office, in a hard plastic chair near a formica table under ugly fluorescent lights, shaking uncontrollably for no good reason. I was not cold or scared, simply confused and exhausted.
Fascinating,
said a very handsome fellow about my age, with dazzling green eyes and neat, close-cropped hair, who was standing over me and contemplating me with a grin.
If that's what you were like when you got drunk in college, no wonder you don't have a boyfriend.
Give her a few moments, I heard an older, softer male voice say. I knew that voice had a name attached to it.
Yoda? No, Yoda was from Star Wars. Star Wars was on my mind because of R2-D2. And the fellow in front of me, I had seen him brushing his teeth before. So if he wasn't my boyfriend, maybe he was a brother I'd forgotten about. He began to laugh.
Stokes, he said, you're saying all of that out loud. I wouldn't speak until you feel like yourself, but hurry up with it.
He leaned closer and whispered into my ear,
we've got our witch vault. Let's go get our witch.
Diachronicle. Day 294. Continued. In which we meet Ursabet. And then we meet Ursabet. First, Tristan had to break the news to the Maxes and the Vladimirs that they had been working all this time on a project whose end goal was magic. He did this in the one remaining non-demolished office, so I didn't have the satisfaction of seeing it happen. They seemed to me to be biting back amusement when they filed out of the briefing. To a man, they all avoided direct eye contact, and the corners of their pursed lips occasionally wiggled. Tristan and I arrived at 420 Common Street in Belmont in earliest afternoon to find, to our dismay, a de-sanctified church converted into some kind of institutional group housing. Welcome to Elm House, read a non-elucidating pastel blue plastic sign planted in the forecourt. Hmm, I said.
Could be interesting,
said Tristan.
Could mean someone's messing with us.
We parked on the street and followed the walkway around the side of the old church, and across a modest lawn dotted with generic dutiful landscaping. The old church had been built on a very large lot, much of which was now occupied by 3- and 4-story buildings, with a decidedly mid-20th century institutional vibe. The main entrance was in one of those. The inside was bland and sterile, like a hospital admitting room. There was a linoleum lobby floor and a laminate receiving desk, where 2 bored 30-something women chatted quietly and ignored the handful of elders beyond them. In a carpeted room full of primary color bingo charts and large posters of MGM movie stars.
At least it's not a loony bin,
Tristan muttered, relieved. All of the residents were either asleep or muttering to themselves despondently, or staring up at a very loud screening of the African Queen. It smelled of old furniture in here, and disinfectants. As we stepped into the lobby, a twig of an ancient woman, keen-featured and remarkably upright, immediately approached us. She was wearing a 1950s-style cocktail dress, which might have flattered her in the 1950s, but looked absurd on her now. She was clutching a large Versace knockoff bag under one arm. Before I even had the presence of mind to greet her, she spoke in a hushed but furious tone, with a well-educated Eastern European accent.
I cannot believe how long you have kept me waiting, Melisande. It is very rude, and after all this time, I deserve better. I see you cut your hair. It looked better long. With those bangs, you resemble a rodent.
I stopped so abruptly that Tristan bumped into me. He began to say something, but she pushed ahead before he could.
You must be Mr. Tristan Lyons. Are you her lover?
Did she say I was?
Tristan asked immediately, which was a pretty good recovery. The old woman made a dismissive tch.
No. Only she is a woman of unreliable morals, and you have a powerful secret government position, so I presumed.
Ma'am, how about we talk in private?
Tristan said.
You've cited a few things that raise security questions.
Of course we talk in private. You're taking me to the Odek this instant.
Tristan took her skinny arm in his large hand and stood over her, his chin a handspan above the top of her head.
Ma'am?
He asked very softly.
Where did you hear that term?
From her,
she said impatiently, poking me in the shoulder. I've never met this woman, I said to Tristan, recoiling from her, and then to her. I've never met you.
Not yet, but you will.
She retorted impatiently.
I am Elizabeth Carpathy. It is absolutely time to get out of here and go to the Odek. I dress specially.
She gestured to her cocktail dress.
Do you know how long I have been waiting for this day?
Ma'am,
said Tristan. It seemed he was stalling for time until he could form a complete sentence.
How long have you been waiting?
Far too long, she said.
Her first post to me on Facebook was a month ago, I offered.
You've been waiting a month?
Asked Tristan.
Piff,
she said.
That's because I got tired of waiting for you to find me. I joined Facebook as soon as it was available to the public, as you told me to.
A pause as Tristan considered this.
You're saying you've been waiting more than a decade for us to come and find you?
Ha!
It was a dry, humorless sound.
I have been waiting for more than 1.5 centuries. And this woman!
She pressed on before we could interrupt incredulously.
Gives me the words Facebook and Tristan Lyons and Odek and tells me this. Now this is the exact month to use those words to find you after so much time. So, we have found each other. Take me to the Odek.
Tristan nudged his shoulder against my back, encouraging me to speak. Was it possible he was speechless? And did he expect me to be less so than himself? Why are you so eager to get to the Odek? I asked.
Because I can do magic again in the Odek, she said impatiently. Obviously.
Tristan frowned at her.
Ma'am, I need you to know that if this is your idea of a joke, you're making trouble for yourself. If somebody's put you up to saying these words, I need to know who it is and why.
Her! It's her!
She said irritably, jabbing her bony little finger into my shoulder again.
I would be dead right now, except for her. I have stayed alive all these years because she commanded it.
Ma'am, I've never met you, I protested again.
Don't you call me ma'am, you hussy. You're older than I am.
She checked herself with obvious effort.
That is, you were, when we met. I have now been old for longer than most people have been alive. Do you know how boring that is?
Tristan had collected himself enough to play the polite West Point cadet card.
We'd love to relieve your boredom, ma'am. Let's step outside and you can tell us the whole story. How about that?
He said.
Do we have to sign you out or something?
Poof!
She hummed, with a dismissive gesture toward the reception desk.
Nurse Ratched has given up trying to control me.
Which one is she?
Tristan glanced toward the desk.
Tristan? I said, come on. My not knowing DARPA pales compared to your not knowing Nurse Ratched.
I call all of them Nurse Ratched since the movie came out,
Erisabeth was meanwhile saying.
It amuses me.
You've been here since One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest came out? I asked.
Yes! Do you see why I want to leave? Boring!
Let's get her outside,
muttered Tristan. It was cool outside and nobody else was out there. The uninspired landscaped path wended its way around groupings of wrought iron benches, at which the residents might have a modicum of privacy with guests. Erisabeth, with a remarkable grace of movement, seated herself in the center of one bench, leaving me and Tristan to share the one across from her, squinting into the bright spring sunlight.
This is where people argue with their children about their inheritance,
she informed us.
I have no children, so I do not have this problem.
If you will, ma'am, let's start from the top, suggested Tristan. Name, date of birth, place of birth, basic background.
She sat pertly upright and gave him a self-important look.
You will take notes?
He tapped his head.
Mental notes for now. Begin, please.
I am Erisabeth Karpathy, she said. I was born in Budapest in 1832.
No, said Tristan. No, you weren't, ma'am. That's absurd.
She glared at him, and seemed to relish doing so.
Do not disrespect me. I am a witch. When magic was fading from the world, Melisande warned me that it would end soon. And the last magic I ever knew was a spell to slow my aging by as much as possible, so that I would still be here. Now, when we could be useful to each other. I did not want to do that, you know.
She went on, directly to me.
I could have just grown old and died. That would have been less boring than surviving this last century. This is a terrible country for all people. You put them away in horrible buildings that are completely shut off from life, and then do everything possible to keep them alive. It is a very stupid system. You should all be shot. Nevertheless,
she pressed on, when we failed to agree or even respond,
here I am, and here you are. So, put me in your automobile and take me to the Odek. I am very eager to do magic again.
Tristan rubbed his face with both hands, as if he were suddenly very tired.
Give me a moment, ma'am,
he said. He pulled out his phone.
How do you spell your name?
If you Google me, you will be disappointed, she said. I know how to keep my profile low,
as you see. I use a different search engine, he said. You'll be on it. Just spell your name, please.
The only Erzsébet Karpaty in Tristan's secret search engine was a 37-year-old aerialist turned legal clerk, currently living in Montreal. There was an Erzsébet Karpaty living in Rome, but she was a madam. And anyhow, our interlocutor sneered that the name without an H was Ukrainian, which she most certainly wasn't.
Then maybe Erzsébet Karpaty is not your real name, said Tristan. Ma'am.
Can we go now? She said, standing up. I have been thinking about my first spell for decades, and I am very eager to perform it. And then I want to go roller skating. They won't allow that here, those toads.
Tristan remained seated and leaned against me to signal me to do likewise.
And what spell might that be?
She grinned at him.
You'll just have to see. It's entirely beneficent, if that's what you're worried about. We go.
The Odek doesn't work yet,
he said, studying her face carefully.
Since you claim to know about it, maybe you can help with that.
You need to up the sampling rate on the internal sensors,
recited Erzsébet smugly, in a triumphant tone, as if she just won a spelling bee. Wow, I thought. Testing her, Tristan replied,
It's going to be hard pushing that much data down the leads.
Swap the twisted pair out for fiber,
she rejoined promptly. It was a recitation, something she had memorized the way a child memorizes indivisible in the Pledge of Allegiance.
All right, let's go,
said Tristan, standing up and again putting his large hand around her tiny arm.
The car's right there, and you are not leaving my sight until I understand what you're up to.
Thank you, she said. Finally.
She did not say a word on the 20-minute drive from Belmont to Central Square, merely stared out the window with the bored rapture of a dog or a baby. I used the silence to recollect myself. Everything this woman claimed seemed insane, and yet... She knew me by sight. She knew Tristan by name. She knew about the Odek. To accept her claims meant... It meant we were about to witness genuine magic performed for the first time in at least 170 years. That rocks, I thought. That was much more exciting than going to New Orleans. I glanced at Tristan as he drove, but he was lost in his own thoughts, which seemed grumpier than mine. When we pulled up in front of the building, Erzsébet sighed heavily.
This is it? Bah! I thought it might be a nice place, she said from the back seat. This is worse than where I have been living.
It won't be as boring, I promised.
That's true,
she said with a sudden grin, and leaned forward to tap my shoulder.
I am very much looking forward to this.
Then to Tristan.
I think you will be pleased with the results, Mr. Tristan Nyans.
I'm certainly looking forward to seeing what happens, ma'am,
he said tersely. I realized he was nervous. For what would happen if, after all this, we found the world's only surviving witch, and she was a dud? He still wouldn't tell me who he was answering to, but his derriere was on the line in a way mine wasn't. When we entered the building, I walked toward the professor and his wife, gesturing for Erzsébet to join me. But she spared them only a brief glance, then waved dismissively in their direction and gazed at the large contraption, taking up most of the space.
Is this it?
She asked Tristan, sounding offended.
But it's so ugly.
She's a little preoccupied, I said apologetically to Oda Sensei and Rebecca. They, in turn, were so fascinated by her appearance that they hardly noticed my speaking to them. Likewise, the Maxes stopped their sundry duties and paused to look at her sideways, nudging each other's shoulders and murmuring between themselves. She took no interest in any of that.
This?
She demanded again.
I go in here and I can do magic? Just like that?
Hang on a moment, said Tristan, pulling out his phone. I need to document you since there is no record of your existence. I need your signature in a photo.
Before she could object or even notice, he snapped a photo of her on his phone.
You don't need my signature, she said.
She stared at the Odek with a rapture greater even than Oda-sensei's, face aglow with anticipation.
I forgive its ugliness if it does its job well. I just go in and start doing spells again?
That's what we're hoping,
said Tristan. She looked at me, her eyes dewy and bright.
Thank you, Melisande. Thank you for bringing me here.
And back her attention went to the Odek door.
Hang on, said Tristan as she approached it. Let me explain what happens when it's activated.
He opened the door with an oven mitt and gestured inside. We could all hear her expressions of surprise, and then he leaned in close to her, voice calm and businesslike, detailing what was to come. The Odas, the Maxes, and I looked round at each other with various facial expressions, all of which were a way of saying, in silence, holy shit. This is really happening, I said, my pulse dancing. Seeing Tristan and a witch standing at the Odek door suddenly made my heart thrill. But for him, I at this moment would be grading worksheets on syntax. I sashayed over to them. Should we put her in the ski suit? I asked Tristan.
I need no protection from the forces that restore my magic to me,
Elisabeth scoffed. But it will be cold in there like Siberia.
She said. It will be invigorating.
It might invigorate you to death, warned Tristan.
She made a face that had already, in the last 40 minutes, become her signature look. A dismissive pout with contemptuously knitted brows, head tilted slightly to one side, and a brief, subtle eye roll. I suppose on another sort of face, a sexy villainess from a silent movie perhaps, it would have had a sultry quality, but on a centenarian, it just looked silly.
I am strong in ways you do not know, she assured him.
Tristan and I exchanged looks. I felt myself increasingly thrilled that this was happening, and impressed with Tristan's unflappable calm, although it is true his face was proverbially shining with excitement.
Stokes, suit up and be in here with her, will you?
Do not call her Stokes. That is disrespectful.
Elisabeth scowled.
You are a disrespectful man. You called me a liar before. Do not get on my bedside. You will regret it. But?
And here she turned to me with a smile, no less fierce than her scowl.
I agree for Melisande to be with me for the first spell. It is fitting. She was the cause of the last spell.
Tristan and I exchanged confused looks, without commentary.
Tell us about this first spell of yours, Tristan requested.
She shrugged offhandedly as she set her bag on the console and riffled through it.
It is nothing. It is very simple. I must simply undo an earlier spell. That's all. Then I can begin doing what you ask of me. Hurry, Melisande.
I left the chamber to find the snowsuit, donned it, and re-entered the Odek, pulling on the oxygen mask. Elisabeth regarded me, appalled. She was fidgeting with something I could not see well. Through the lens of the mask, it looked like she was massaging a mop head. Before I had a chance to ask her about it, she was on to Tristan again.
You make her dress like that? She said to him. I don't like you at all.
It's for her own protection,
he said tersely. He had stopped calling her ma'am. Elisabeth, in her outsized vintage cocktail dress, and I, in my snowsuit, balaclava, and oxygen mask, stood beside each other as Tristan, just outside the Odek, raised his thumb and closed the door on us. There was a brief wait as Oda and the Maxes and Vladimirs went through their checklists. I glanced at the old lady across from me and felt an extraordinary combination of sentiments all at once. Excitement, disbelief, anticipation, confusion, fear, hope.
Had anyone told me this would be how my spring were to unfold, I'd have laughed my ass off at them.
I'd have scoffed. Seriously.
I remember what happened for about the next quarter second. The dim sound of the klaxon outside. The hair standing up on the back of my neck. The lights going out. In that precise moment, a lovely aroma, both floral and musky, overwhelmed me. And then, as before, I lost all clarity. And the next thing I was aware of was somebody peeling a balaclava off my head. I was lying supine in a vaguely familiar office, my back propped up against that somebody's knees.
Stokes? You okay?
I took a moment to think about this. Only the fellow from the shadowy government entity called me Stokes, so this must be him. His name was something from a medieval romance. Percival? Lancelot.
Tristan, he corrected, grinning down at me. But I get the Lancelot thing a lot.
He roughed up my hair.
Come on, sit up. Meet our new witch.
Memory came flooding back. Yes, I said unsteadily. Ersabeth, I've met her.
No, he chuckled. You haven't. Take a look.
He propped me farther up under my shoulder so I could look across the room. About 20 feet away from me, near the control console, stood a stunningly beautiful young woman, hardly more than a girl, wearing Ersabeth's dress. The garment now curved and clung to an exaggeratedly shapely physique, almost perfectly hourglass. Her hair was shoulder length, thick and full and dark, her eyes a deep green. She mesmerized us all by simply standing there, with a gleeful, impertinent smirk, tugging the perfect curve of her mouth to one side. With Tristan's assistance, I rose to my feet terribly awkwardly, the snowsuit making synthetic slithery noises as I moved. I felt like a yeti in the presence of a gazelle.
Meet Ersabeth Carpety, said Tristan, beaming. She's our witch.
Diachronicle. Day 294, continued. In which every little thing she does is magic. Everyone in the room was staring at her. Oda Sensei, Rebecca, the Maxes. The gleeful, impertinent smirk fixed on Tristan. Tristan started to laugh in a breathy way, trying but failing to suppress glee.
Wow,
he said. Against my upper back, his torso shifted slightly.
We did it!
He sounded giddy. Everyone applauded, looking rapt.
I did it, she corrected him.
The accent, which had made her sound crabby when she was nearly 200 years old, now made her exotic, adding to the glimmer of her beauty.
I warned you do not want to get on my bad side.
Doesn't look like you have a bad side, I said, so that Tristan wouldn't. Her attention turned to me and she grew more serious.
Do I look more familiar now?
She asked.
This is how I appeared when we first met. I was only 19, but I was a prodigy. You were lucky that I was the one you found.
I'm sorry, but we really have never met before, I said. And then to Tristan, almost under my breath. I'd like to get out of this thing, please. It was foolish to feel so self-consciously lumbering, just because there was another young female in the room who happened to be crazy gorgeous. I was not used to being fawned on by anyone. Tristan treated me like an extension of himself. But suddenly I felt somewhat gruesome. Tristan, eyes glued to Ersabeth's face, and curves, I am sure, released me so I could unzip myself from the snowsuit. But even wearing civvies, I felt doltish, while this elegant creature held us all entranced. Entranced is not the right word, though. That conjures a sense of a doe-eyed fairy tale princess, and Ersabeth was not that. She was fierce. Not deliberately, not like the alpha girl in a high school clique. It was effortless on her part, elemental, and she seemed amused by how her transformation distracted the rest of us.
The experience was very pleasant,
she continued to Tristan in a so-there tone.
Do not presume to tell me what is good for me or not, ever,
again.
Got it,
he said almost meekly. His eyes kept sinking toward her bosom, as if lead weights were attached to them. Then, with visible effort, he would wrench them back to her face. There was a long pause, as we all continued to register what we were witnessing, and she continued to bask in our collective gaze. Various low voices said, "Wow," or something equally articulate. We were more dumbfounded by the fact of the transformation than by its result, although I cannot stress enough how impressive the result was. But we were definitely dumbfounded, and she was definitely preening. Then Tristan collected himself.
So,
he coughed slightly.
All right, then. How did you just do that?
It was a big spec, not easy, she said offhandedly. But I have been thinking about it, rehearsing it in my head for 160 years, since the groundwork for it was laid in Budapest. I did it to see if your Odek works to my satisfaction.
She smiled, and shifted her hips a few times so that the hem of the cocktail dress swirled around her knees.
It does. In fact, it was never so effortless to do a spell as in this Odek, which I like very much. What should I do next?
What kind of magic were you in the habit of doing before?
Tristan asked. Without taking his eyes from her, he pointed toward the small table on which sat a MacBook Air.
Stokes?
I collected the laptop and dutifully seated myself, opened the audio recording software, and pressed record. For backup, I decided to take dictation and remain there, fingers poised over the keyboard. Ersabet sobered abruptly. Even grave, she was mesmerizingly beautiful.
I was young, and magic was waning, and it was a very turbulent time. My mother was in the service of Lajos Kossuth, and if you know anything about our history, you will realize her magic was often ineffective. I assisted her when she required it.
Eyes still on Ersabet, Tristan signaled to me. Lajos Kossuth, I said, typing.
With a J,
she said to me. I overlapped. A J, I know. Her beautiful dark eyes flitted back to Tristan.
I like that she's educated,
she said, as if approving of him for this, then continued her narrative.
After the revolution failed, after Kossuth fled in late 49, the aristocracy would call upon my mother, or myself, to perform stupid parlor tricks. We would change the color of somebody's hair, or force somebody to speak a childhood secret out loud. It was deliberately degrading to us, and I resented it. But my mother was so alarmed at our weakening powers that she grew fearful of displeasing those horrid people. She became sycophantic, which disgusted me, and so I went abroad.
Where to? Asked Tristan.
I wanted to follow Kossuth, but his wife did not want me in his sight. Instead, I went to Switzerland a while to train with a powerful witch who was making sure younger witches still learned certain spells and charms that had fallen out of use as the world perceived we were losing our power and relied on us for fewer things. Her efforts were, in retrospect, somewhat romantic, as if somebody in today's world were teaching how to measure longitude with a timepiece. I learned much that I had little occasion to use, but I was still glad for the learning, although eventually I rejoined my parents in Budapest.
So you can change somebody into a newt?
Tristan asked, getting to the point.
Of course I can, she said. What a stupid question.
Can you change them back? I asked quickly.
If I feel like it, said Ersabet complacently.
She gave Tristan a slightly defiant look.
Do you wish to test me?
He pondered a moment, assessing her on so many levels.
Let's start with an inanimate object, he said. I assume that's possible. I mean, can you transubstantiate inanimate objects?
Tell me what you need,
she said with a suddenly inviting smile. Truly, it was almost a grin. For the first time, she and Tristan were in the same groove, and they smiled at each other. He bit his lower lip excitedly, which made him look charmingly like a goof. Then he clapped his hands together in front of him, actually squatted slightly like a coach laying out a game plan. It was the first time I noticed, fleetingly, that he had a cute butt.
Just going to put you through some paces on the most basic level today. Stokes will take notes. Ms. Stokes will take notes.
He corrected himself quickly, staving off her irritation.
I wish those stupid aristocrats who made us do parlor tricks were still alive,
Elizabeth said eagerly.
The pains I would bring upon them now.
Never mind about them, said Tristan. You'll have plenty to occupy you right here.
For the rest of the afternoon, Tristan tasked Elizabeth with simple assignments, for which we were all the amazed witnesses. I can hardly describe the electricity in that dull warehouse that day. Our breathless wonder at the impossible turned evident. Even though she began with the humblest of efforts, the whole thing was totally fucking... was mind-blowing. Here follows a sampling, and then I must move on to what happened afterward, as I still have not accustomed myself to writing with a dip pen, and this is far more painstaking than I had realized when I began this project. And I am running out of time. To begin, Tristan put a gallon of white paint into the Odek with Elizabeth and asked her to turn it black. She did so, and after the Maxes took a sample to have analyzed, she returned it to white, which was also sampled. She could turn it any color, we learned. She could match it perfectly to colored objects Tristan gave her to take into the Odek with her. She could not reproduce this effect when the paint or object sat outside the Odek, to the frustration of both herself and Tristan. He then had her bend metal rods into perfect circles, splinter stones, break glass, and then restore it. It was clear now that anybody actually inside the Odek with her could not, by definition really, remain mentally coherent, and so each time she set about to work her magic, she did so alone. Sealed up within the Odek, her workings remained a perfect mystery. These acts of magic each took between 5 and 30 minutes to achieve. While happily invigorated after the first dozen or so, she presently showed signs of tiring. Tristan chose not to notice this and tried to step things up a notch. He asked her to materialize something out of nothing.
There is no such thing as nothing, not even in what you call a vacuum. But I am tired now,
she said, lolling against the control console.
Materialization is a complicated summoning and requires many calculations. And I am tired of taking orders from you, Tristan Lyons. Perhaps tomorrow.
It was clear from her tone that Tristan should not bother asking more of her. He looked both contented and resigned.
That's a wrap, then, he announced to all of us. Back here at 0900 tomorrow. And Miss Carpathy, thank you for your efforts today. You have begun to change the future of magic. Thank you.
She made her now usual dismissive face, and otherwise did not respond. As the Maxes, who had scarcely left off staring at the beautiful witch when she wasn't in the Odek, began to collect their jackets and such like, I had the sudden thought, where are we going to put her? Clearly, we could not return her to the nursing home. I was startled by Rebecca's soft voice behind me.
How large is your apartment?
I turned to her. Not large enough, I said. Rebecca sighed rather pointedly to get Tristan and Oda's attention.
Well, then, she said in a slightly raised voice, I suppose we must, but only for the one night.
Elizabeth heard this and smiled. She straightened up and strolled toward us. And then, in a moment of unguarded bliss, She threw her hands up and cried triumphantly.
How wonderful not to be in prison anymore!
How many guest rooms do you have?
Tristan asked Rebecca quietly.
I'm responsible for her. I have...
You are not responsible for me?
Said Elizabeth, immediately exchanging glee for contempt.
And you have no authority over me at all.
Excuse me, miss, but if it wasn't for me, you'd still be a crone living in a retirement community.
You had nothing to do with that, she said dismissively. It was Melisande who found me. Not that she has authority over me either, but I owe her at least a debt of gratitude.
Journal entry of Rebecca East Oda.
May 19th. We've brought all three home for the night. I made it clear they must respect this as our home, not merely a dormitory for experimental physicists and their sideshow curiosities. Obviously didn't say that. Still in shock about Elizabeth. Immediate disagreements about sleeping arrangements. We have the guest room, double bed, and May's room, twin. Tristan said he would take May's room, but Elizabeth demanded to sleep alone. Then, Elizabeth, it is ridiculous that you, Tristan and Mel, refuse to share a bed. Mel, we don't refuse to. Elizabeth, good, then do it. Mel, it's just that we don't. Elizabeth, why not? Mel, we're not romantically involved. Elizabeth, why not? Mel, because we're just not. Elizabeth, that answer is too stupid to justify depriving me of my own room. Even in that prison, I had my own room to sleep in at night. Mel, he snores very loudly, and I won't be able to sleep. Tristan, yeah, it's terrible. Women leave me all the time because of it. Elizabeth, they leave you for other reasons. Mel, so please, let's you and I share the double, and Tristan has his own room. Elizabeth, I cannot believe the indignities I am already having to suffer under your regime. Sharing not just a room, but a bed. I haven't had to do that since the 1930s. Tristan, you want to go back to Elm House? I'll drive you. Mel, let's everyone just calm the fuck down. Tristan took Mel aside to discuss surveillance of Elizabeth. Assuming my role as hostess and lady of the house, I stepped in to see how she was settling in. She had left the elder hostel with only one large bag of faux leather that looked stolen from a fashion shoot. She was removing her possessions from this bag and laying them out neatly on the painted wooden dresser. Ancient boar bristle hairbrush, couple of camisoles and dresses, small satin bag for toiletries and makeup, nylon stockings, plus one object made of yarn or string, a kind of fiber sculpture. The calico had leapt up onto the dresser to examine this, but seemed to know better than to swat at it. I looked closer at it. It was very old and frayed in places. Its central artery was a length of spun wool, perhaps as long as my forearm, and tied to it were several hundred more slender strings of varying lengths. All bore multiple knots along their lengths, knots of varying shapes, sizes, complexities, and densities. A number of strands were deliberately entangled to each other, and some of the strands were tied together into bundles thick as my thumb, creating an effect like dreadlocks. It resembled a design I remembered from my favorite college class, on South American anthropology. So I assumed that what appeared to be the ruins of a mop was, in fact, a calculation and record-keeping device. "Looks like an Andean quipu," I said. "Mmm," said Elizabeth absently, removing her shoes and wiggling her toes. "Mine is better." She shooed the cat off the dresser. What do you use? Sorry, I said. What do you... She stopped herself, blinked, looked lost. Never mind, she said, sounding cross but looking confused. I forget there is no magic now except in this Odek. She gave me a searching look. So you can't do magic? Ever? That's right, I said, neutral voice, neutral expression. Well, you can now with this Odek room, she said. I don't do magic, I clarified, hoping Mel would return and interrupt this conversation. I have no idea how to do it. Ah, she said, still distractedly, and began to brush her hair. Of course, if it cannot be done, then it cannot be practiced or remembered. I wonder, will Tristan Lyons require me to show witches how to do magic? Probably. I don't see myself volunteering to become a witch, I said. She paused in her brushing to give me a curious look. You are already a witch. Excuse me, I said. I don't know where you would get that impression from. Do you think that just because I knew what a kipu is? That's nothing to do with magic. It's because... She resumed brushing her hair. Of course you are a witch, she said with offhand impatience. You smell like a witch. What? I demanded. What do you mean by that? She shrugged. What is the scent of a baby or an old person or a man in love? There are different human scents. You have the scent of a witch. How wonderful it feels to have a full head of hair to brush again. You take these things for granted when you're young. Excuse me. I'm not a witch, I said. That would be ridiculous. Then your mother's mothers were, she said very matter-of-factly, setting the brush on the dresser. Some ancestress, you carry the blood. Suddenly I was irrationally angry at Frank. Did my husband tell you to say that to me? I would not say something because your husband told me to. Ha! What an idea! I have an ancestor who was hanged in Salem, but she was not a witch. Well, somebody was, she said, and peered into her toiletries bag for something. This is nonsense, I said, ruffled. I don't have one of those, pointing to the kipu-like object. And I don't do magic, and I'm not a witch. And I shall go put on deodorant right now if you think I smell like one. You act as if I have insulted you, she said, sounding amused. She took a bottle of witch hazel and a cotton pad from the little silk bag. I have given you the greatest compliment. Not by my lights, I said. As soon as I left her, I confronted Frank, who never understands that the Salem witch hysteria is inappropriate for jokes. He claimed innocence, pointed out that he had never been alone with Erzabet, but then, since the matter had been raised, I suppose, repeated his perennial joke theory that Mary Esty really was a witch. Now that we know there really are witches, don't you want to know? He said with his eager little knowing grin. Wouldn't that be something? How could I ever fault him his curiosity? So, made sure the guests were settled in with bath towels and water glasses, and then went up into the attic to Nana's trunk, which I have managed to avoid opening for a quarter century, despite Frank's nudging. God knows why I felt compelled tonight. I already know the family tree. I don't require seeing it in writing. But something pushed me to go up. I pulled the string on the bare bulb that hangs from the attic ceiling, knelt down by the heavy cedar chest that lives equidistant from the central chimneys, windows, and attic door, blew the worst of the dust off the top, grasped the two near corners and lifted carefully, as the wood creaked in protest, The clasp broke at least a century ago. Inside, I saw the sheaf of family papers I knew would be there. But then I saw something I had never noticed before. I thought it was a cow.